Hey, good morning, everybody. So this is Bio 241, and it is August 3rd. That's right, it's September. September 3rd. Correct the record, September 3rd. And we're in the middle of Chapter 6. I don't think we're going to finish 6 today completely, so that means that I'm going to postpone the test until Thursday, which is good and bad. All right, it's good you get a couple extra hours to study, right? But that still means, though, that you got to really study over the weekend, because if you don't start studying until next week, as a matter of fact, if you haven't really started studying already, it's probably too late, right? So just make sure that you do spend your time wisely over the weekend, please. So just pretend it's on Tuesday and you're ready to go. Make sure you know all of the figures down cold by Tuesday, because we're going to go over some figures. And if the first time you see them is on Tuesday, it will be pretty confusing for most students, right? So make sure you're studying some of those figures already. Sign-in sheet is going around, and your SI leader, Helen, is going to have SI today, but she's also going to have a practice test on Thursday before the exam, all right? So SI is still going as scheduled. And she's making some photocopies for everybody right now, so she's just not in class right at the moment, but she'll be here shortly, okay? Okay, so test on Thursday. Hope you have a nice weekend. But are there any questions? Yep, on Thursday. So the SI, right, the SI is at 9:30, and the test is at 11:30, so it's okay. We don't have to be in two places at one time. So it works out okay. Yeah. I don't know what to say about that. Yeah. Oh, Tuesday and Thursday? Ah, Tuesday review, Thursday review, review test. Okay. Okay, so everybody should be able to take advantage of that. Yeah. Yes, you do. The quarter page one, the green one. I believe it's an 882E. I don't like the 882E Lovas because the bubbles are filled in with some kind of background color, and the Scantron reader gets confused sometimes. So get the Scantron with the clear bubbles. And also within the bubbles, there are letters, capital A, capital B, capital C, capital D. That's the best kind to get. There are some Scantrons that have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 across the line. Well, the way I make up my test is that the answers are A, B, C, D, E, not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So if you don't want to go through that conversion process, just get the ones with the capital letters and the clear inside the bubbles, right? But I can go over this on Tuesday. I'll bring in an example on Tuesday, all right? Okay, so we're still, we're talking about mixing up different chemical solutions, and that actually plays a big role on how cells behave, what kind of shape they have. As a matter of fact, if they're going to be normal cells or even if they're going to explode. And you don't want to have any exploding cells in your body, so we got to become really familiar with some of these concepts. Okay, oops, I went a little bit too far. All right, so the difference between molarity and molality, this is where we left off last time. A one molar solution is when we take one mole of solute. Now, what? Tell me something about solute. What does that mean? What's a solute? It's something that you dump into a solvent to make a solution. Yeah, so you got to know those. So the two parts of a solution is one part is going to be solvent and the other part is going to be the solute. And so a good solute in this particular case we're using is glucose. That's the sugar. It's going to dissolve very nicely in water, which is the solvent, because of all those polar hydrogen bonds that bind to oxygens on a sugar molecule. All right, so if you take one mole of solute and put it in a beaker, all right, and it's a graduated beaker right here, flask, so you know exactly where the 1 liter mark is, and then fill the beaker up to exactly the 1 liter mark. That's a one molar solution, all right, but that's going to be less than 1 liter of water, right, because you already put some sugar in this container right here. That's going to take up some volume. So one molar solution doesn't specify the exact amount of water. So that's maybe not so good for biological systems, because how important is a molecule of water? It's very important. It participates in chemical reactions, right? So there's a little bit different way that we can mix up solutions, and that is a molal solution. A molal solution, we still start with one mole of solute, okay, like one mole of glucose, and we can calculate the how much that would weigh, right, using a periodic table right here. It's 180 grams. So if we take 180 grams, put it in that beaker, but now instead of filling it up to the exact 1 liter mark on this flask, right, we put in exactly 1 liter of water. And 1 liter of water, by definition, weighs 1 kilogram. All right, so we put in 1 kilogram into that beaker. So now the total volume is going to be greater than 1 liter, because there's 1 liter of water, plus there's some volume of glucose in there as well. All right, so that's a molal solution, and how you would mix it up if you had to mix up a molar solution versus a molal solution. All right, so why do you think some of these things are important? Because of the way that it affects osmotic pressure inside a cell. And there's even a third term that we have to use, especially important in biology, and that is the term of osmolality, because that really determines the osmotic pressure that a solution can develop. Right, and it's abbreviated capital OSM. So that's the total molality of solutes in solution. All right, because when we put glucose in solution, if we make up a one molal solution of glucose, right, it doesn't dissociate. You still have the same number of particles. You have an Avogadro's number of particles in solution. But if we put sodium chloride in solution, guess what happens to sodium chloride? It breaks apart into two molecules, so now you actually have twice the number of particles, so you have twice the concentration of particles in water compared to glucose right here. So it exerts a greater osmotic pressure. All right, so here is sodium chloride. When we put it in water, remember what kind of bond that is? What kind of bond is this? Binding sodium and chloride together. It's ionic, so what kind of bond is that in terms of strength? Relatively weak. Put it in water, sodium chloride dissociates, so now we have two particles right here, right? And so what that's going to do, since we have two particles over here, the water concentration is left on the right-hand side compared to the left, so water is now going to move down its concentration gradient across this membrane right here. And how could you talk about this particular membrane? Okay. We don't, hopefully this color and this color over here is different. I can't tell, but can you see that glucose has to stay on this side of the membrane? All right, and sodium chloride stay on the right-hand side of the membrane, but water can go across, so this is a selectively permeable membrane. So when water moves by diffusion down its concentration gradient across a selectively permeable membrane, what do we call that? That's osmosis, right? That obeys all the criteria for osmosis, because water is the solvent molecule. All right, and as water moves across, it exerts a pressure and pushes this membrane over to the left, even though the molar concentration, right, is exactly the same. But the osmolar concentration is a lot different because sodium chloride dissociates. Now, do you think that might be important in your body? Do you have sodium and chloride in your body? Yeah, exactly right. So we have to be concerned in biological solutions this osmolar concept, right, because of the way that it can push on various membranes. That produces an effect called tonicity. Right? Tonicity is the effect of a solution on the osmotic movement of water, and there are three conditions that I want you to become aware of. Right? Isotonic means that the pressure on either side of the membrane is going to be, what does iso mean? Is going to be the same. And hypo means less than, and hyper means more than. All right, so let's take a look at this. Maybe I'll just diagram this on the board. You can copy some notes down. Okay, this might be a little bit of a problem if I don't have a marker. That's a little bit better. So here we have a beaker. And let's put a cell And can you see that in the back? I don't know, it's a little tough, huh? A little tough? Good enough? Okay. So here we have a cell. And inside this cell, we've got typical cell 0.9% solute. And I'm just going to put NaCl to represent all the solute that's inside that cell. The sodium, the chloride, the potassium, the glucose, everything is about 0.9%. Everything else is water. So how much water do we have in a typical cell in terms of a percentage? It is going to be what? 99.1% H2O right here. All right. And let's say that this is a nice red blood cell, and red blood cells do have aquaporin, so water can go across the membrane, but salt can't. Salt is trapped inside, can't go across. So what kind of membrane is that? That's a selectively permeable membrane. Water could go across, so that process is called osmosis. All right, so let's put it in a solution of just pure water. So here's pure water. What's the percentage of salt in pure water? Zero, right? So 0% salt, NaCl, how much water? 100% water, 100% H2O. So since osmosis is going to take place, how is water going to move, or is it going to move? It's going to go from high concentration to low. What's a higher concentration, 100% or 99.1? You're going to say, dang, not much difference. But to be truthful, 100% is a little bit higher concentration. So which way is water going to move? It's going to move in. Indeed, it's going to move in. And guess what happens to the shape of the cell right here as water moves in? It swells up. Okay, and as a matter of fact, this small difference right here, concentration of water, is enough to blow the cell up. Right? It's going to hemolyze that cell. It's going to burst the cell. Okay, and so that process, right, is what we call hemolysis. And the kind of solution that causes hemolysis is a hypotonic solution. Hypotonic solution, that means that there's less pressure out here. So what happens to the cell? If there's less pressure outside the cell, what happens to the cell? It expands, right? And it expands so much that it disrupts that membrane and it bursts. Right, so would you ever want to give a hypotonic solution as an IV to anybody? No, because what are you going to do to their red blood cells? You're going to hemolyze them, right? So they're just going to explode, and that's not helping anybody. All right, well, let's consider another condition. Let's put that same cell in a beaker, and what's the concentration? 0.9% NaCl inside of a cell, 99.1%. H2O. And now let's put this in some salt water. Does anybody know what the concentration of salt in seawater is? Okay. Yeah, I don't know either. Let's make something up. Let's say 5% NaCl. That seems a little much, all right, but that's good enough for our calculation. So how much water is going to be in here? 95% H2O. All right, and so osmosis can take place across that cell, but will it? Will osmosis take place? Because what is osmosis? It's just a special case of diffusion. Will water diffuse? What do you need for diffusion? For diffusion, you just need a concentration gradient. You need a difference in concentration. All right, if there's no difference in concentration, diffusion will not take place. All right, do you see a difference in concentration of water? Yeah. What's higher, 95% or 99.1? 99.1 is higher. Diffusion always goes from high to low, so water is going to leave the cell. All right. And as the water leaves the cell, it shrivels up. The cell gets spiky and jagged like that. And that's what we call crenation. That's crenation. And the solution that causes crenation is a hypertonic solution. Oh, that's an R. Hypertonic. Meaning what? Higher pressure. So this solution is doing what? It is pressing down on the cell. Think of it that way. Causing it to shrink or to crenate. All right. Now, if we have a bunch of cells and they're hemolyzed, can we ever get them put back together again? As a matter of fact, we can. So that's an irreversible process. If you have a balloon and blow it up so much that the balloon bursts, right, you can't, like, do anything to that balloon to get it back. But if you have a balloon full of air and let the air out, can you blow air back in to get the balloon again? Absolutely. So this crenated cell can be rehydrolyzed. You can get its shape back. You haven't really killed the cell. So how would you get the shape of this cell back again? Okay. We can put it in another kind of solution. All right, we can put it in another kind of solution to rehydrate that cell. So let's just start with a normal cell here. What do we got here? 0.9% NaCl, 99.1% H2O, and let's put it in a solution that has the exact concentration of water in salt. All right, so 0.9% NaCl and 99.1% water. All right, so there's aquaporins in this cell right here. Water can move across the membrane, but will it? Water will do what? Go from high concentration to low. So what's higher, 99.1 or 99.1? They're the same. So the amount of water that moves in has got to equal the amount that moves out, and this cell maintains its normal shape as a result of that. So this kind of solution is what we call isotonic. That's an isotonic solution, and it preserves the shape of that cell. And as a matter of fact, if you take a crenated cell that has a lower water concentration than it should and put it in an isotonic solution, then it's what? Automatically going to get readjusted, rehydrated, and it's going to attain its original normal shape. Okay, so it's very important when people get drugs by IV that the tonicity of that IV is adjusted so that it is isotonic, so that you neither crenate nor hemolyze their cells, right? So it's really important to do that. So maybe in lab, I don't know if you've done this in lab yet, but you're certainly going to do it one of these weeks, right? So if you put a red blood cell in an isotonic solution, nothing changes. If you put it in a hypotonic solution, it's going to swell and eventually hemolyze. And if you put it in a hypertonic solution, then of course it's going to crenate. All right, so you got to remember some tricks of some kind, maybe to remember what happens there. Yeah. Oh yeah, some really gruesome diseases actually. 2 years ago, maybe three. There was a radio station, I think it was in Texas, that said whoever drinks as much water as possible in a period of maybe an hour or 2 hours or something will win a nice pickup truck. Okay, and so some people came in, and there was one person that maybe drank 2.5-3 gallons of water, right? And that got absorbed from their digestive tract and went into their blood. So what happened to the osmolality of their blood? Okay, the salt concentration just plummeted. Their blood is now full of water. All right, and what's the concentration of water inside their cells? 99.1%, but the concentration in their blood went way up, was almost like this condition right here, so it just diffused into all the cells of that person's body. And they started acting delirious, and blood pressure was out of control, and they were passing out, so they called the emergency room, and a nurse said, yeah, you got to make sure you come into the ER immediately, because that's a life-threatening situation, and certainly stop drinking. And the person said, you know, I really want this truck really bad. So I think they kept drinking, and the person didn't survive, because they didn't go into the emergency room, okay? So what happened was, and this is probably the cause of death, not only were, so I don't think any cells were necessarily hemolyzing, but every cell in their body was expanding, including your brain. All right, but where's your brain located? It's inside your cranium, your cranial vault. And what? The cranium can't expand, and so usually what happens when somebody overdoses on water, the brain expands, and what happens then? Well, it gets pushed out of the cranial vault, namely through all the foramina of the brain, especially of the foramen magnum, and that destroys the brain as a result of that. Okay, so that's what she died of, right? Just that expansion of the brain. So Yeah, these do have some really important considerations. The opposite, probably what will hurt somebody the most in the opposite case is that you lose the ability to thermoregulate. So then you just die of hyperthermia. And that's kind of interesting because it's really important this time of year because there are a number of athletes that are exercising super strenuously right now. And in the past, there have been high school athletes, college athletes, and even professional athletes that should know better than that. But they're usually football players, and they start doing 2 and 3 workouts a day when it's over 100 degrees outside, and they just lose so much water that they almost can't drink enough to maintain their fluids, and they pass out, and it's really too late to help them in a number of cases. Okay, so. And that's really true for somebody, and that's really a healthy person, right? But that's especially true, for instance, of your grandma and grandpa under these conditions, because as we get older, we have more and more difficulty regulating our body temperature because we can't sweat. So hyperthermia is really important for the elderly population. Somebody had a question? No? Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah? If when you're dehydrated, yeah, that produces blood that's hypertonic, and all the cells in your body will start to shrink. And what the point of this class is going to learn, how does your body compensate for those conditions? Because as your blood becomes more concentrated or less concentrated, you're moving away from the set point, right? And that's eventually going to be fatal. So what are the mechanisms inside your body that will bring your osmolality back to normal? So that's one of the last slides that we're going to look at, but we need to introduce some of the basic concepts first. Okay. All right, I forgot something else that I was going to say. So how are you going to remember? Hypertonic causes crenation. A hypertonic solution causes crenation. Well, I'll just think the higher pressure on the outside is going to squish the cell down. Hypotonic, the cell is just going to expand. All right. I know when I took one of my first physiology classes, I remembered it another way, which is really kind of juvenile way of remembering something, but it worked for the test. I'd be happy to share that with you as long as you don't tell anybody I told you this method. Okay? Because in hemolysis, what do you got? You got an O. And in hypotonic, you have a nice O. And in crenation, what do you got? You got this nice E, and in hypertonic, you got an E right there. But you should understand the mechanism of what's going on, because this class really involves mechanism more than just memorizing like we did in anatomy, okay? But so, if you have to give this lecture in 20 years, right, you can always remember how it goes by that little trick right there, okay? All right, oh, well, we don't have to wait till later on in the slides, because this shows the regulatory mechanism for adjusting osmolality of your blood. All right, so blood osmolality is maintained in a very narrow range of about 300 milliosmolar. All right, so if dehydration occurs, there are osmoreceptors in our brain, in particular the hypothalamus. Can you kind of point to where the hypothalamus is in your brain? It's really closely associated with, what would you say? It's just right inferior to the thalamus, of course, but it is also just superior to the pituitary gland. Okay, so it's intimately connected to the pituitary gland. So when you're dehydrated, your blood volume decreases. Oh, and that produces something. What happens when your blood volume goes down? We're going to talk about this later on in the class. Say if you go out to your car and you take air out of the tire of your car. What's going to happen to the pressure in that tire? It's going to go down, yeah. So, for instance, if we take blood volume out of your circulatory system, one of the consequences is going to be initially what? A drop in blood pressure. That might not be so good. All right, so decrease blood volume, increase plasma osmolality. That's the same thing as saying an increased saltiness of the blood. It's getting more concentrated. That triggers these osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, and that is the integration center. It has the set point for what the osmolality should be. What should it be? 300 milliosmolar, And so then the hypothalamus says, ooh, error. We got to do something to correct this situation. It makes a decision, and then it sends that decision out to various parts of your body, namely the pituitary gland, and then another place in the hypothalamus, which gives you the sensation of thirst. So when you get the sensation of thirst, and if water is available to you, what are you going to do? You're going to drink, all right? So you're going to drink. But the hypothalamus also tells the posterior pituitary to increase the solution of antidiuretic hormone. That is typically called ADH. So ADH, antidiuretic, let's think about what a diuretic does. What does a diuretic do? Makes you pee. An antidiuretic keeps you from peeing, or it makes you produce urine in very small amounts that are very concentrated. So it preserves water that you have in your body. All right, so ADH works on the kidneys to decrease the amount of urine production, and these two things work together, so you're losing less water from your body, plus you're drinking, you're putting water back in, right? So that increases water intake, increases water retention, that feeds back, all right? So this is what the effect feeds back with the stimulus in what kind of way? Does it add to it or subtract from it? It subtracts. Right? So blood volume goes back up, plasma osmolality goes back down to normal. So this maintains a state of homeostasis by this nice negative feedback mechanism. Right? As long as you have water to drink and you don't take other things in your body that screws this up. And there are drugs that screw this up, like methylenediamine methamphetamine. What's that? That's ecstasy. Okay, so that stimulates thirst centers in people's hypothalamus. All right, and a lot of folks, they used to, I don't know if you guys still do this or not anymore, but you could stay up all night, right, and dance all night long and have a good time, and when you're exercising really hard, what are you doing? You're sweating, so you're becoming dehydrated. And so people realize that they should stay hydrated. And then they have this overpowering sensation of thirst because of ecstasy, so they drink way too much water, and sometimes that produces an overdose of water. So you can overdose on water. Right? So if you know anybody in those circumstances and they end up in the emergency room, always tell the healthcare providers what's going on. Don't tell them. Don't withhold information. Okay? Because people do die of water overdose because they don't share with everybody what's happening with them. Okay, so just a little bit of caution right there. All right, membrane transport systems. So we're changing the topics. Here's the sign-in sheet. Does anybody need the sign-in sheet? Yeah, I'll just pass it straight back, please. Okay. So molecules that are too large or too polar to diffuse through a membrane are transported by protein carriers, right? Because why can't a polar molecule get across the membrane? Why can't a polar molecule? Tell me something about a plasma membrane. What's the simplest way of thinking about a plasma membrane? It's a phospholipid bilayer. Notice the key term there is lipid, which is on the inside of the membrane. So it doesn't allow water or polar molecules to move across the membrane because it just doesn't want to mix with polar compounds, right? That oil layer in the middle of a membrane wants to have nothing to do with anything that is polar. So there has to be a channel, there has to be a protein. So now what layer on top of your phospholipid bilayer and understanding of what? The fluid mosaic model. We put proteins and other kinds of things into a membrane to give specific function to various membranes. So if a molecule is going to be transported across a membrane, it's got to bind to that protein carrier first before it's transported. And carrier-mediated transport has a number of different characteristics, right? So they exhibit specificity, and that's what this means. If there is, so I'm going to erase our really good diagram right here, all right? If you have a molecule that's going to be transported across a membrane via some kind of carrier molecule, here's the membrane, and here's the transporter right here. Right, this molecule's got to bind to this one, so there's got to be some site on the carrier, and guess what? The shape has to match up properly. So if the binding site on this carrier protein is like that, Does this look like a proper carrier protein for this molecule? Just by shape, it is not. All right, it has to actually be what? This kind of shape before it can be transported. So a lot of processes in your body are controlled by shape-to-shape interactions. And when the shape changes, guess what happens? The functions of these proteins change as well. Okay, so this carrier protein can carry this molecule across the membrane. That's what we call specificity. Right? That's the first term. So carrier proteins are very specific, right, according to the shape of the molecule. So if you have a molecule that maybe has this kind of shape, well then that might work. Okay? But as soon as you get farther and farther away from this square kind of shape, the less and less this carrier protein is going to work. Okay. If we look at this graph right here, let's look at this graph to understand some of these things. Let's just plot out the rate of transport of some molecule, like X right here. Here's molecule X being transported across this membrane. The rate of transport of X across the membrane is going to increase as we increase the concentration outside the cell. Okay? So, and notice in this region right here, it's pretty linear. All right, but after a while, the rate of transport does what? Does it speed up? It actually does what? All right, here's the rate of transport. As the rate of transport gets bigger, you have to go what? Climb higher and higher and higher on this axis right here. But at this region, what's happening? It is staying the same, even though we are increasing the concentration of X. So this plateau region right here is what we call saturation. And that is because maybe this one carrier can carry across 10 molecules in 1 second. All right, so if we have 10 molecules over here, it can transport all of them in 1 second. But now if we have 100 molecules over here, how many can it transport in 1 second? It still can only do 10. Right? So if there's one molecule, it can transport one molecule in a second. If there's two, then it can transport two. But as soon as it gets close to 10, it starts to level off because that's what we call the transport maximum. And that's that phenomena is what we call saturation. Right? So that is saturation of molecule X. Right? So just look at these two axes, rate of transport versus concentration. All right? So that's specificity and saturation. There's another important consideration, and that is competition. All right? And so I have, what do we have here, X and Y? Yeah. So let's just say this is molecule Y. And what does molecule Y do? It can still have access to this binding site, and it might beat out compound X. And if it's occupied, what does that mean? That excludes X from being transported. So there is competition if the molecules have basically the same kind of shape and can fit into this active site over here. And we see that on this graph right here. All right, so for X, right, so this is concentration of X, and this is what? The rate of transport of X only. The dotted line is the transport of X. It is decreased when there is a competing molecule for the transporter in the membrane. All right, so you reach a new transport maximum when you have competition for that protein in the membrane. Okay, so why is this important? Important for a number of disease processes. For instance, even something like diabetes mellitus. And what's the molecule of concern when somebody has diabetes mellitus? It's glucose, right? So let's look at some glucose, and in particular, how glucose gets into cells. So here we have, what does this look like right here? A phospholipid bilayer. But here we have a protein also embedded in it. This is a kind of fancy carrier molecule, and it will allow a cell to take up glucose. So here is the intracellular side, here is the extracellular side, and notice where is glucose at high concentration? Outside the cell. So this would be in a fed state when we have high glucose concentration in our blood. And glucose can't get across the plasma membrane by itself because of this lipid layer right here. Glucose is very soluble in water, can't get across the membrane because it's a relatively big molecule, plus it's very polar. So there have to be transporters in most cells. And this is what it looks like. This molecule has to bind. And can you see that the shape of the binding site matches up with the shape of the molecule somehow or another? This is just an illustration. And when glucose binds to this transporter, look what happens to it. It changes shape, right? It has an open, and initially it has an opening to the outside of the cell, but after binding, that causes a conformation in this protein, and now the opening is on the inside of the cell, so this glucose can end up inside the cell. And does glucose want to go in this direction automatically? And what term would we use to explain that? That would be, but remember, osmosis is just a solvent molecule. Is glucose a solvent? It's a solute, right? So, but still, glucose will move even as a solute from high concentration to low concentration by diffusion. Just simple diffusion. Does not require energy, right? And you might be wondering, well, right, why is this molecule right here, this protein, changing shape? Well, you should think of that glucose. It's like somebody poking you in the side. So if somebody pokes you in the side, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to change conformation too, right? Maybe drastically. So much I wouldn't even think of poking somebody I don't know in the side, right? Because when you bind a molecule right here, remember the conformation of this protein is held together by strong bonds, like covalent bonds, but also by all kinds of weak bonds. Hydrogen bonds, van der Waals forces, ionic bonds. So just the binding of a molecule here could tweak the molecule one way or the other and cause a conformation change, but it is not denaturation. Yeah. Okay, it requires a little bit of energy, and I'm going to talk about it in this chapter. The energy source is really the concentration gradient. Whenever you have a concentration gradient, that is an energy source. All right, and what does energy really mean? Energy is just the ability, yeah, that's biological energy, but energy just means the ability to do work, all right? And so there is energy in this concentration gradient. So if the concentration of glucose was the same across this membrane, what would happen? In other words, if there's no concentration gradient, can glucose move from one side of the membrane to the other with this mechanism right here? You know what? Then there's no energy for transport, and it won't. All right, so glucose can't be concentrated one way or the other. It can only go down its concentration gradient with this kind of carrier protein for glucose. Okay, now these proteins are not always in the plasma membrane. They're usually found in vesicles. So here is a vesicle, and what's the structure of this membrane right here of a vesicle or any membrane in your body? Phospholipid bilayer, just like the plasma membrane right here. So this membrane is very similar to the plasma membrane. So here are transporters in a vesicle. These vesicles have a special name, and we call them endosomes. And they are responsible for routing these carrier proteins. They can take the carrier proteins out of the plasma membrane and put them inside the cell in this vesicle. And when that happens, can this cell take up glucose? Because where are the carrier proteins? They're stuck inside the cell, right? So in this case, these carrier proteins are completely unable to allow this cell to take up glucose, right? So when this cell is signaled, when it receives a proper signal, this vesicle moves over to the plasma membrane, fuses with the plasma membrane, and now what does the plasma membrane have in it? These transporters for glucose. And then this cell can take up glucose. And as a matter of fact, this is how insulin works. Insulin allows these endosomes to insert their transporters into the plasma membrane so that cells can take up glucose. All right, and when cells take up glucose, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It goes down. Okay, when cells start to gobble up glucose from the blood, then blood glucose concentration goes down. So that's the essential pathology that we find in somebody with diabetes mellitus. Glucose is trapped in their blood because these transporters don't get put into the plasma membrane, And as a result, what happens to all of these cells right here? Well, they starve to death because they don't have glucose, okay? Because glucose can't get into the cell. All right, so this is an example of facilitated diffusion. And facilitated diffusion means that the molecule being transported, namely a solute, goes from high concentration to low. Hence that name, diffusion. It can only go down a concentration gradient. And it's, we call it facilitated. Why? Because it doesn't automatically happen across the membrane. It needs this protein inserted in the membrane. And where does it get this protein from? This endosome right here. And the signal that causes the endosome to place these carrier proteins in the plasma membrane would be insulin, for instance. Okay? Okay. So that's facilitated diffusion. Another kind of movement across a plasma membrane is what we call active transport. Active transport means that something can go from low concentration to high concentration, but that doesn't happen automatically. What's required? It requires energy of some kind. What's your favorite energy molecule? That should roll out of your mind really easy. That's ATP, right? So ATP can be used. So here we have a cell. This is intracellular. Here's extracellular. And let's think about calcium. Calcium typically is low inside the cell and is high outside the cell. And it's in that condition because here is a protein molecule that can actively move calcium outside of the cell with or against the concentration gradient. It's against the concentration gradient. But in order to do that, what do you need? You need an energy source for that to happen. Okay. And if it is, as a matter of fact, you probably should change your notes right here. Oops. That's right. I can't edit in this slideshow mode. Put primary. All right. Say primary active transport. If it's primary active transport, ATP is the molecule that is required. So ATP is going to be broken down, as we see right here. So ATP binds to this protein, and then it gets broken down into ADP and inorganic phosphate, and there is a lot of energy released that twists and turns the protein molecule. Again, it's like really poking you in the side now with two fingers, all right? So big conformation change. So now this protein opens up to the outside of the cell, and calcium can be released to the higher concentration right here. All right, so things can go from low concentration to high as long as ATP is used. So this kind of protein, moving things from low to high, typically we like to think of that as, and in your mind you should think of that as like a, what do you have at a well, like when you go camping someplace. A lot of times you don't have the little faucet that you can just open up, you actually have to. You've got to pump the water out of the ground. The water goes from low to high. That requires energy, so we call that a pump. So this is a pump. This would be what kind of pump? Would this be a water pump? This would be a calcium pump. And it requires what as an energy source? ATP. So if you have any kind of pump that requires ATP, what are we going to call that kind of transport? Primary active transport, because it's relying on ATP to do that. Okay, so here is a very special pump right here. This is called the sodium-potassium pump. All of your cells in your body have these, and I think I talked about ATP before. How much ATP do you need every day? A lot, like 40 kilograms, more than half your body weight, and most of the ATP that you use every day is to run this pump right here, just this one. Right, the sodium-potassium pump. Normally, outside the cell, you have a low concentration of potassium. Inside the cell, you have a high concentration. And one of the reasons why is because of this sodium-potassium ATP pump right here. And I might have to go back and listen to what I said. Hopefully I said it right. In a normal cell, you have low sodium on the inside and high sodium on the outside. Did I say that right the first time? Hopefully I said potassium. All right, potassium is low on the outside, potassium is high on the inside. Sodium is the opposite in terms of the cell. It's low on the inside, high on the outside. So that you just have to memorize somehow or another. All living cells, most living cells, let me qualify that, obey that rule. Okay? High sodium on the outside, high potassium on the inside. All right, so what do we need to get sodium to move up its concentration gradient? Is that passive transport or active transport? It's active transport, right? Going from low to high is active transport. And since it uses ATP, furthermore, you could say it's primary active transport because we see what right here? ATP. This might be an exam figure, right? So anytime you see a pump or anytime you see active transport happening and it's using ATP, automatically you have to think, what kind of active transport is that? It's primary, right? Primary active transport. Okay. Let's introduce another kind of concept, and that is secondary active transport. All right, so if ATP is responsible for primary active transport, do you need ATP for secondary active transport? And the answer is no. It's going to have some other form of energy that's going to be moving something, right? And if it's active transport, how are things going to be moving if it's active transport? High to low or low to high? Yeah, it's going to be from low to high, right? So it's the same direction as primary active transport, but there is something else that is being used as an energy source. All right, so secondary active transport uses the coupling of a couple things to in order to move something against its concentration gradient. So let's consider what molecule we want to move against its concentration gradient, and let's pick glucose once again. All right, so here we have a nice diagram, and on the vertical scale, we have concentration represented. So if it's lower down on the illustration, it means what? Low concentration. And if it's higher up on the illustration, it means a higher concentration of something. And in particular, what we're interested in is glucose. So the end result of this illustration right here is that glucose is going to go from what kind of concentration? Low concentration to high concentration. All right. Will that happen automatically, going from low concentration to high concentration? It won't happen automatically. What do you need to get that to go? You need energy, okay? All right, so here is another mechanism. We call this secondary active transport. Over here, when you see glucose moving up its concentration gradient, do you see any ATP? There's no ATP over here. Hence, we say that is secondary active transport. The thing that's moving glucose up its concentration gradient is sodium, which is doing what? It is running down its concentration gradient. All right, so there is a concentration gradient for sodium, and I mentioned this one time before, but I'll probably mention it a bunch. There is energy whenever you have a concentration gradient of something. All right, and that energy in the gradient of sodium can be coupled with what we see on this illustration right here, a teeter-totter, can be used to drive glucose up its concentration gradient even though there's no ATP directly being involved right here. Okay. But how do we get a concentration gradient of sodium? The easiest way of doing that is with the sodium-potassium pump. And it is an ATP pump, so this is what? Primary active transport. So a primary active transport mechanism can be coupled to drive a secondary active transport mechanism. All right, so sodium will be moved from low concentration to high, meaning what? It's going to get kicked out of the cell, right? It's going to move out of the cell from inside to outside, but in order for that to happen, what do you need? You need the sodium-potassium ATP pump, right? Do you see sodium moving outside the cell right here? And since it uses ATP, what kind of active transport is that? That's primary, right? And now since it's high outside the cell, what does it want to do automatically? It automatically wants to, by diffusion, move back into the cell, right? And there is sufficient energy in this gradient to also move glucose across the cell membrane. And so this is what we call secondary active transport. So the key things that you want to always look for is in active transport, is ATP being used? If ATP is being used, you're going to say, what kind of active transport is that? Primary. If something's moving against the concentration gradient from low to high, no ATP being used, you're going to say secondary active transport. But then you should also be interested in what is actually moving down its concentration gradient to cause secondary active transport. Okay. All right. So there are a couple different kinds of secondary active transport. There's something called co-transport and something called counter-transport. Yes. Oh, I tell you what, speak up really loud. Oh, secondary active transport uses some kind of coupling mechanism to drive a molecule against its concentration gradient. All right, but it's using a gradient of, say, sodium to do that. All right. And actually, that's really one of the most important reasons why we have this big sodium gradient, because it can be used by all kinds of cells to do, since it's energy, the cell can use it to do what? To do work. That's what energy allows us to do. Allows us to do work by moving glucose against its concentration gradient. Okay. All right, so let's look at a couple other kinds of secondary active transport. Here we have that glucose molecule. All right, and here we have sodium. And in this particular case, both molecules have to bind to the transporter protein. Right? We have glucose concentration is higher on the inside of the cell. And so glucose is moving in. So is that simple diffusion? If glucose is going from low concentration to high concentration, right? If glucose is going from low to high, is that diffusion or active transport? It's got to be active transport. Now, do you see ATP here anywhere? No. Can it be primary active transport? Cannot be. So it's got to be secondary active transport of some kind. Right? And it's using the gradient of sodium, because sodium is high on the outside, low on the inside. And what direction are both of these molecules going in? Same direction. So that's an example of co-transport or symport. When both molecules go in the same direction, utilizing the energy in the gradient of one of those molecules, that's what we call symport or co-transport. So this right here we see is nice secondary active transport because there's no ATP. Both molecules are going in the same direction. That is co-transport. Antiport means that one molecule would move out while the other one moves in. Right? But just think of this protein that's changing conformation as what? Like a teeter-totter, like we saw on the previous slide, going back and forth. So whenever a molecule binds to this protein, how should you think of that? Like somebody poking you in the side. You're going to change conformation, right? And this protein is going to wiggle back and forth when that happens. Okay, so here's a pretty interesting exam figure that you guys should really know backwards and forwards. So let's see what we have right here. So here we have the lumen of some kind of tube, and over here we have the blood, and what kind of tissue lines a tube, the lumen of some kind of tube, whether it's the tube like a blood vessel or a kidney tubule? Is it going to be muscle or nervous tissue or connective tissue or epithelium? Yeah, epithelium lines the cavity, right? Covers the surface. So here's an epithelium. Another way you could tell this is an epithelium is because these cells are closely tied together, right? And you know that this cell is specialized for absorption because I see all these microvilli right here, all these convolutions that increases the surface area for absorption. So here's a nice apical surface. Here's the basal surface. And these cells are polar, meaning that the apical surface is a lot different than the basal surface. It has different proteins. So on the apical surface, we have a protein that will transport both sodium and glucose inside the cell. All right? And if it's going to transport two molecules in the same direction, what do we call that? That's symport or co-transport. All right? But now let's look at this. The cell, all cells have what kind of concentration inside for sodium, high or low? Inside the cell, sodium should be low. Outside should be high. And indeed, we see this in this illustration as well. Here we see high sodium in the lumen of this tube, and it is low inside the cell. So what does sodium want to do? It wants to rush inside the cell. So there's what? There is energy in that gradient. And we also want to absorb glucose from a kidney tubule, because if it's left in the tubule, we're going to lose it in urine, and that would be a big waste of energy. So here is a special protein, a co-transporter. When both sodium and glucose bind to it, it's going to cause a conformation change, and then those two molecules end up inside the cell. So sodium goes from high to low, but what about glucose? It goes from... Oh, I'm sorry, I said it wrong. Sodium goes from high to low, down its concentration gradient, and it drags along with it, what? Glucose, which goes from low concentration to high. So as a molecule goes from low to high, is that active or passive? It's an active mechanism of some kind. And do you see ATP here being used? No. So what kind of active transport is that? Secondary active transport. Right, so that's how important that sodium gradient is. So for instance, in our cells, if we run out of ATP and we can't maintain that sodium gradient, what happens to all your cells? Well, they die because of all these processes that stop happening, because the sodium gradient is such an important energy source. All right, so now we got sodium inside the cell, which is low concentration, and we have glucose that's high inside the cell compared to the blood. So which way is glucose going to want to move? From inside the cell to the blood, or from the blood back into the cell? Just by passive motion, by passive diffusion. Passive diffusion does what? High to low. So glucose wants to leave the cell and go into the blood, but it can't because it can't get through the cell membrane. But how can we solve that? By putting a carrier protein right here that just carries glucose across the cell down its concentration gradient. And what do we call that? That's a special kind of diffusion. We call that facilitated diffusion. All right, now how do we make sure that sodium remains at a low concentration inside the cell? We kick it out. We pump it out. And what do we use for that? The sodium potassium ATP pump right here. It's using ATP. You see ATP being used up. So what kind of active transport mechanism is that? That's primary, because you see ATP. If you see no ATP, that's secondary. If you see ATP, that's primary active transport. Okay? Kind of just simple as that. So this is a really good exam figure, right? Because you get to practice what is secondary active transport, what's primary active transport, looking at the concentration gradients, you know what's active versus passive diffusion. So just try to become familiar with this diagram. So even if there's just multiple choice questions, having a picture in your mind really helps you answer word questions. Okay? So if you can't label this diagram, then you got to go back even further and just draw it out from a blank piece of paper. All right? So if you can draw it out on a blank piece of paper just from your mind, then you should be able to label it and use that picture in your mind to answer questions on the test. Okay. Okay, bulk transport is a way for cells to take up material or to move material from one side of the membrane to the other, and it's through the formation of these vesicles and the pinching of the membrane, this invagination of the membrane, and it's going to require microtubules and microfilaments that slide past each other, pushing and pulling on the membrane, and you know what? That's an active process. So that requires ATP, so this bulk transport that we see on this slide is our examples of primary active transport, and it relies on ATP for these to function. Whether it's endocytosis, which is bringing material in, or exocytosis, it really doesn't matter. Okay, and you should probably be aware that there are two kinds of endocytosis. One kind that is bringing particulate matter inside the cell, and the other is bringing solutes and fluid inside the cell. And that's what we call pinocytosis. So pinocytosis is cell drinking and phagocytosis is cell eating. But they're all just forms of, is bulk transport passive or active transport? It's active. Yeah, it's active transport. It requires energy in the form of ATP. Okay, one of the last topics in this chapter is the membrane potential. All right, and when you hear that term, potential, that means that there's an ability for something to happen and it's just waiting to happen. All right. And another good way to think of potential is to think of it as a voltage. All right, so what the heck is a voltage? So membrane potential could also be considered a membrane voltage. And what this is, if we look at some solutes in solution, all right, we have a bunch of solutes way over here, all right, and then just a couple over in this direction, are these solutes going to move around? Yeah, how are they going to move around? Yeah, from high concentration to low, just by diffusion, right? So there is energy in the gradient right here. But instead of just thinking of the number of particles in solutions, let's give a little electrical charge to these particles. What kind of particles are you familiar with that have an electrical charge on them? Like what? Somebody say one.
Calcium.
Ah, that's a good one. Calcium, as a matter of fact, has two positive charges on it. Does anybody know one that has a negative charge?
Chlorine.
You know, you will today. Chlorine has one negative charge on it. How about one that has a single positive charge?
Potassium.
Yeah, potassium has a single positive. Sodium. All right, so you guys know that that stands for sodium, right? So you should be studying that already. All right, so these charges right here have to do with what? Those valence electrons. All right, so what do we call all of these molecules?
Ions.
You could maybe call them electrolytes if you wanted to. But you can see that this ion is a lot different than this one because the charges are opposite. As a matter of fact, even if they have positive charges, calcium is a lot different than potassium because calcium has two, and potassium and sodium only have one. So we have to sometimes consider these charges. All right, so what kind of ion is this sodium? I don't know if I talked about this. It's a cation, okay? And in particular, we call this a monovalent cation. All right? Because it has how many charges? Just one. Guess what we would call this one right here. What about calcium? It would be, instead of a monovalent, that would be either a divalent or maybe bivalent. People use those terms interchangeably. Bivalent what? Cation, because it's positively charged. How would you talk about chlorine, to be very specific in its charge? It's a monovalent anion. Monovalent anion from this group would be this one right here. Okay, so that's how we talk about different ions in solution. All right, so let's put some of these in solution. Let's not think about them by name. Let's think of them by charge. All right, so let's put a bunch of positive charges over here and over here and maybe a couple negatives. And then over here, well, let's just put a couple positive charges with a lot of negative charges. What do these positive charges want to do? Yeah, they want to go down their concentration gradient to neutralize some of these negative charges over here, right? And if we put a membrane between them, we see there's more positive over here, there's more negative, so this side of the membrane is what? More positive compared to this side, which is more negative. And as a result, that produces a voltage. And that voltage we call a potential as a result of that. And is there energy in this potential? Yeah, because those charges want to move across the membrane, right? Just like if there's a concentration gradient, there is energy in that. Okay. And as a matter of fact, and what do we call a device that has two terminals on it that look like this, right? That produces, okay, that separates charge out into two locations. This terminal here versus this terminal here. What do we call that? That's a battery. Who's ever used a battery? We probably all have batteries in our pockets or our purses or something, right? And what do we use a battery for? It's a source of energy because this charge has been separated. And when the charges are no longer separate, what do you got to do? You got to recharge it up again, So we use that terminology all the time. All right, so what devices do you own that contain a voltage or a battery? Cell phone, calculator, all kinds of things. I don't think anybody has a pencil. There's a few pencils that have batteries in them because they have little lights and things like that. Okay. And how many terminals? It has two terminals, right? And one is going to be positive, the other is going to be negative, right? Or if we say one is zero, this would be positive. But if we say this is zero, what would this one over here be? That would be negative, right? So usually one terminal is defined as the reference terminal, and we measure the voltage to the other terminal. Okay, and it's just kind of arbitrary how we hook it up. Okay, now the interesting thing is that every cell in your body acts like a battery. So you're loaded with batteries. As a matter of fact, you have trillions of batteries that make your body up. So this is kind of a strange concept, I think, in physiology. You probably don't consider yourself very electrical in your basic nature, but you are, because of all of the chemicals in your body, namely ions, right? Make you very electrical. All right, so when a cell is made, it makes a bunch of proteins that are kept inside the cell. They're way too big to get outside the cell membrane. And these proteins, by their basic nature, are covered with electrical charges, and the kind of electrical charge is a negative electrical charge. So the very basic nature of a cell is that on the inside of the cell, it is very negative on the inside because of all these proteins that are produced by protein synthesis, right, transcription and translation, produce all these negative charges inside the cell. And that helps produce this membrane potential, right? And these can't get out, right? Because it's positive outside, that would draw these proteins outside the cell, but they can't get out because they're way too big. All right, but there is an ion, namely potassium, right? You could recognize that as potassium, and potassium is what, a monovalent cation. And if it can get through the membrane, what's it going to want to do? It wants to neutralize all of these negative charges by the proteins that are inside the cell. And indeed, that's what happens. Potassium gets attracted to the inside of the cell by these anions, right? But how much potassium is actually going to enter the cell? This is what we want to consider next. All right, because if now we have a high concentration of potassium outside, inside the cell and low outside, what does potassium want to do? Just by concentration gradient, and wants to get out. So potassium is being pulled in due to the electrical charge. It's being pushed out by the concentration. So there's a competition between those two forces. And so there's an equilibrium that gets established, one that partially neutralizes the electrical charge and then partially maintains the concentration as being equal across the membrane. And it just so happens that sodium, let's say that sodium is not permeable. And there's something else. What else is happening to sodium? Primary active transport is doing what? The sodium-potassium AT pump, right, is pumping sodium outside of the cell all the time. Okay. So we have a little bit more potassium inside the cell than outside because of this electricity that's pulling it in. And we can measure what that equilibrium is by putting a voltmeter on something, right? We can measure any kind of battery with a voltmeter, and maybe if you had a car to find out if your battery's dead, what do? You get a voltmeter and hook it up across the terminals and measure the voltage. So if we take one terminal of the voltmeter and put it outside the cell and then take another lead from the voltmeter and put it inside the cell, guess what? If it's a living cell, we're going to see that there's a voltage of minus 90 millivolts negative on the inside of the cell compared to the outside of the cell. And if you can measure a voltage, what can you say about that cell? Or I tell you what, if you have a battery and you don't measure a voltage, what would you say about that battery? It's dead. As a matter of fact, you'd say the same thing about the cell as well. If it doesn't maintain the voltage, it's dead as well. Okay. All right, so the equilibrium, how is that equilibrium established? First, by the electrical attraction inside the cell because of all those negatively charged proteins, But then diffusion is going to try to allow potassium to leave the cell. So it's these two factors, the electrical attraction that's bringing it in, diffusion is forcing potassium out. That's the new equilibrium. And when that's established, we can measure the voltage on the cell. We call that the equilibrium potential when equilibrium is established. And so when is equilibrium established? When the electrical and the diffusion forces are what? Equal but opposite, so that there's no net movement of potassium one way or the other. And the equilibrium potential then is minus 90 millivolts. So what's a millivolt? It is 0.0, is it 9? Yeah, 9 volts. All right, not that small, just two orders of magnitude below a volt. How many volts do you use in your car? 12. All right, so that's not that big a number. All right, so 90 millivolts is actually a fairly large voltage. It's pretty easy to measure. All right, so what does every cell in your body act like? A battery. All right, and so you might think, well, a cell's pretty small. How is it that I can make a little probe and stick it inside the cell? Does that seem difficult to make a really microscopic little probe and put it inside of a cell? You know what? It's not too bad. I used to make them all the time. You take a piece of glass tubing and you heat it up and then you just stretch it really fast when it's hot. And what happens as it stretches? The tube gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and by the time it breaks, it's microscopic. It's really, really small. So, and then you fill it with salt water and it acts like a wire, and then you can, with underneath a microscope, you can take the tip of that glass rod and stick it inside of a cell, and you can use that as a voltmeter. But of course, you got to be really careful with that little tiny glass tube. Why, you think? Well, because you can't really see it, and if you're jabbing it around, you can jab it in your skin, right, or somebody else that's walking by, and glass never disappears once it's inside your body. So you got to be careful with them, right? But you can use that as a little wire that you can put inside cells, okay, to measure this voltage right here. All right, so we can determine what the equilibrium membrane potential is on a cell, right, using the Nernst equation. All right, so that gives the membrane voltage needed to counteract the concentration forces acting on ions that are trying to force potassium outside the cell. All right, so what is drawing potassium inside the cell? It's the electrical gradient, right, because it's negative inside the cell, and potassium is what? Oh, I erased it. Potassium is a cation, so that's going to be drawn inside the cell. Right, and that value, that potential, depends on the ratio of the concentrations inside and outside the cell, and this right here is the Nernst equation. All right, this is some homework for you guys to do. It's an end-of-chapter question. And there's just a little constant of proportionality right here, 61. And then Z is the valence of the ion. So what's the valence? Too bad I erased these. What's the valence of chlorine? It is. So in that particular case, Z would be minus 1. What would be Z if we're going to calculate it for calcium? It would be plus 2. And if it's for sodium, it would be plus 1. All right, so that's not really difficult to understand that. So that would go in this Z position right here. All right, so for most ions like chlorine and sodium, what would be the magnitude of Z? It would just be 1. So 61 would either be positive 61 or negative 61 if we're considering the chlorine ion. And then on your calculator, you got to learn how to use that log button, okay? And then it's the concentration outside the cell divided by the concentration inside of the cell. That would then tell us what the equilibrium potential is, or the equilibrium voltage. So here we have a nice cell, okay? Here's the Nernst equation, and we have a number of concentrations of important electrolytes. We have sodium, potassium, chlorine, and calcium. And on this diagram, what do you have to memorize? You got to know for sure, for a particular ion, where is it high concentration? Right? That just should become second nature to you. Where is sodium high? Outside or inside? It's high outside. What about potassium? It's high inside. And chlorine, where is it high? In a normal living cell, it's high outside. And calcium is high outside the cell, okay? Because it's almost non-existent inside the cell when it's at rest. So you know what? Let's calculate. Let's calculate via the Nernst equation what the equilibrium potential is for potassium. All right, so let's calculate that. Can I calculate that? I can go over here like this, because what do I got? I got a calculator, but I need my numbers. So you don't have to memorize the concentrations. I just want you to know where is it high, where is it low. Okay, where is it high, where is it low? And if I ask you to calculate something, I'll give you the exact numbers. So what do we got to do? Turn on the calculator. Can you see the calculator? I bet I could zoom, but that's okay. All right, so what do we got? We have got, let's do it for potassium. Yeah, potassium is first. So what would Z be? Z would be plus 1. All right, so what's the coefficient? It would just be 61, right? It's just 1 times 61 is 61 times. So we put a parenthesis, and we're going to take the log of something, and it is outside. And so for potassium, it's 5 millimolar, right, divided by, what do we got, 150 millimolar. And you know what? That's it. So I can just hit the equal sign. And that should tell us the voltage in millivolts, minus 90 millivolts. And let's just check, I think on the next slide, I've got it. Minus 90 millivolts. Okay, so that's how, that would be, minus 90 millivolts is pulling potassium into the cell, but that means there's a higher concentration of potassium inside the cell that completely balances the force for diffusion outside of the cell. Okay, and you know, this number right here strikes me as wrong. This should maybe be plus 66 or something. It's close, but not quite. You might want to just put a question mark and check it, okay, with your calculator. All right, so the Nernst equation allows us to calculate the equilibrium potential, but only for one ion at a time, right? We can't put all ions together. That's a different kind of equation that you have to use, yeah.
So if you do it for potassium, you have plus 2, you divide 61 by...
Oh, for potassium? Wait, we just did potassium.
No, I'm sorry, calcium.
Oh, calcium. Yeah, for calcium, you'd have to put a plus 2,
yeah.
Right? So 61 divided by 2, 30.5, right? It would still be a plus times the difference in the concentrations. And then you have to take the log of one over the other. Yeah.
So the plus
2
is the balance.
Yeah, the Z? Yeah. For calcium would be plus 2 because it is what? A bivalent cation. All right, so that's where that Z comes in. It talks about the valence electrons. All right, that. So check that out over the weekend, because I think that's an end of chapter question. All right, and then next time we're going to finish up. All right, so next time we're going to start with this slide right here. So during the test, yes, you do need a basic scientific calculator. That's in your syllabus. All right, to do just a little calculation. But you can practice these things at home. They're end of chapter. And your lab instructor should really know how to do all this kind of stuff.
Okay.
For who? For chlorine. Z is minus 1. Yes. Yeah. That's why that Z is there. Because it's going to change the voltage. It's going to whip it. It's going to switch it back and forth. Okay, don't forget, there is SI today and Tuesday and then on Thursday. So pre-test on Tuesday and Thursday or just Thursday?
Tuesday.
Tuesday as well. Yeah.
Is it okay if I use a TI in there?
Is there a memory in there? Yeah, then you're screwed. You can't use it.
Okay.
Because you could put too much stuff in.
Is there a way to not use memory that I could take out something?
You know, I'm not sure about that calculator.
Okay.
Somebody in the math department might know. Have you ever had a math teacher?
I'm taking math right now. So
ask your teacher.
Okay.
But I...
So it's not the